This is KUOW's The Record. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting all this hour to you at KUOW. Seattle, let's start right there. It is the center of gravity for King County. Seattle has the most people. Seattle has the most influence, which annoys Republican State Senator Phil Fortunato, who represents Auburn and parts of Pierce County. The senator has introduced a bill to make it easier for new counties to form. Senator Fortunato suggests Seattle could go off on its own. That way, the rest of King County wouldn't have to pay for the quote-unquote crazy stuff Seattle does.
They started off with their needle exchange thing. They started off now they want to do free heroin. At one point in time, it's been like 20 years ago, wanted to hire prostitutes to teach other prostitutes how to put condoms on. You know, I mean, they want to have, by the time they're done, they're going to have a $25 minimum wage or $100,000 minimum wage. So, I mean, you know, they're just, the homelessness, they've now become the homeless capital of the state, basically. You know, trying to end homelessness. Now, you can't even drive down I-5 without passing tents on the side of the road and garbage and people sleeping everywhere. You know, I mean, they basically ruined the Emerald City. Part of the problem is it's not only what they're doing within King County, but it's their influence on the rest of the county. That's more of the problem.
Well, King County has its own council and county executive. Isn't your problem with them?
Well, that's true. But when you look at the makeup of the council, because of the high density in Seattle, you have a significant number of the 9 members on the council are actually Seattle-based. So Seattle has a disproportionate influence on the rest of the county. That's why, you know, when they went from 9 members to 13 members to 9, I said, that's actually going to hurt us. That's not going to help us.
You mentioned Seattle's $1,000 minimum wage. What do your constituents want the minimum wage to be?
Well, I think my constituents, the $15 minimum wage thing is, I think it's going to hurt the economy. I mean, my district is a pretty darn reasonable district. I like to think that I'm in sync with them. I mean, I did get a significant portion of the vote. But more importantly, I mean, we are totally in sync on sound transit. I mean, the district voted 64% against sound transit. They understand how money works. They're sick and tired of taking tax money out of their pocket for somebody else's craziness.
You know, even if Seattle were to become its own county, you'd still have Seattle pushing liberal ideas on the rest of the state, higher minimum wage and legal marijuana. So maybe make Seattle its own state would be the only way to solve your problem.
Well, they're going to continue to do that stuff. But right now, once again, they have a disproportionate influence because all the council members from downtown Seattle are all liberal Democrats. And, of course, then you have some of the other liberal Democrats or liberal-leaning or, you know, if not 100% socialist liberal, leaning in that direction, and they're going to vote in a block.
Uh-huh.
So they're going to vote to support each other. I mean, that's what happens down here, and that's what happens in, even though they're, quote, nonpartisan.
Senator, the state legislature has yet to write a budget or fully fund education, according to the Supreme Court. Those are the reasons you're into a special session. Why not focus on those big tasks instead of introducing new legislation?
Well, first of all, I'm not on Ways and Means. I'm not one of the budget people. This, you know what happens when you go into special session? I'm down yesterday. I was the only one in the parking lot. There was nobody here yesterday. Today, it's a skeleton crew. So the only people that are actually here are the budget people.
In Olympia, the people actually working on the budget.
Right. I mean, the budget people. They're down here. They're doing stuff. They have meetings tomorrow. They're going to be hashing it out. They're going to work it out. And when they get all done, then they're going to say to us, this is what we came up with. We're going to then come back, and we're going to give them feedback and all that stuff, and then that's when the budget's going to be passed. But the House Democrats, they have a much harder job. They don't even really have a budget. All they have is, this is how much money we want to spend. They don't have the other side. They said, we want to do these taxes in order to spend this much money, but they never voted on that. We're not supposed to be going in the special session. If anybody thinks that this is some kind of special thing where people want to be down here, that's an incorrect assumption. I mean, I want to get back to my life. It's a citizen legislature. You know, I got work to do. Heck, I've only mowed my lawn once, so the grass is a foot tall. I like to take care of my yard, for goodness sake.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like I want to be down here.
Okay, so jobs one and two, write a budget, fully fund education, and then maybe when you're back in session in a few months, we might be talking about Seattle splitting off from King County.
Well, hopefully we'll be talking about that all summer, and in January we'll actually be coming to the bill signing.
That was Republican State Senator Phil Fortunato, who wants to allow new counties to be formed more easily in Washington State, including one that separates Seattle from the rest of King County. This is KUOW's The Record. Now, here's something Seattle shares with the rest of King County: homelessness. Bellevue plans to build its first permanent shelter for homeless men. The city's working with David Bowling, who runs the group Congregations for the Homeless. And I talked to David and with Derek Wentor from the group Friends of Youth. Derek says homeless people face different challenges depending where they are on the East Side.
There's a number of different communities that make up the East Side. And as you start getting further and further into the foothills, there's a very different experience of homelessness. Rural homelessness in communities like Issaquah, North Bend, Snoqualmie, Carnation is a very different experience than downtown Bellevue, downtown Kirkland, or downtown Seattle. And so the interventions need to be different. But the reality is that homelessness is out there. It used to be the experience that like homelessness isn't here. We don't have this issue on the East Side. We see.
Is that right? On the East Side, it's more like let's ignore the problem.
Well, it used
more
to
so
be
than
that
Seattle?
It wasn't as visible.
Uh-huh.
It used to be that you wouldn't drive around a corner and see people with a sign or see that homelessness is in your community in that visible way.
Why is that?
I can't speak to why it was then. I really do think that our community is at a different. The crisis is growing, right? And there's lots of different causations around why people are homeless. But the reality is that it's really hard to avoid it now wherever you're living in King County. And so with that being said, there are lots of different communities that are coming up with responses in different ways. And so living in the woods and experiencing homelessness, if you're out on the outskirts of Carnation, there's a different way to engage that person and provide them support. But the common thread is that everyone wants to be treated like a person and then given that chance to succeed.
The East Side is so big and diverse. Is that an unfair stereotype, the idea that a homeless person on the East Side would be less likely to want to admit it, that it's more stigmatized, David?
You know, all I can speak to is my experience. I've been working over on the East Side for 12 years. And just like Derek said, I've seen a drastic shift in the last few years where at first the people experiencing homelessness were doing everything they could to kind of blend in and not stand out as homeless. And now, like Derek said, there's people on flying signs on the corners all over. There are people that are just more free in saying, here I am and I'm homeless. And I think, you know, I've wondered about that culturally, what shifted. And I think I can speculate that the East Side's growing up some. In the past, they just saw themselves more of a bedroom community, and it wasn't necessarily safe. And when I say safe, I don't mean physically harmful, but not necessarily safe to go, I'm struggling over here because this didn't fit the identity of the East Side. And what I see in the last few years is the East Side is growing up going, we're a bigger community. We're grappling with some of these bigger issues, and let's own that and let's address it. So that's a real positive that I'm seeing.
Mm-hmm. Derek's nodding his head.
Yeah, no, I definitely see that. I think I will say that whether it's Seattle or the East Side, that the vast majority of people who are experiencing homelessness don't want to be known that they're going through that crisis. They want to be known as Derek.
That's a universal.
That unquestionably. And so I think that the reality of seeing more people is the reality that there are more people experiencing homelessness. And, you know, whether it's like U District and you walk down the Ave and you can see so many young people that are out there on the street struggling through homelessness, they've found a community there. They've found connection. And what they came from was a lack of community, typically family instability or other, but they found that cohesion with young people on the street on the Ave, and that's their community. But for every one young person you see there, there's multiple young people that you don't see that are accessing shelter, that are trying to go to school, that are in a job. So I don't think that there's that big of a difference between the East Side and Seattle homelessness around that issue of wanting to be known whether or not you're homeless. We have a lot of kids in schools that are experiencing homelessness, that their main goal is to make sure that they don't stand out.
I saw a quote in the Seattle Times. I don't think it was attributed, but it was that at this Bellevue City Council meeting, that leaders there said that this Eastgate shelter coming to Bellevue is going to reflect Bellevue values, including expectations that it would help the men become self-sufficient and exit homelessness, and not, as critics charged, enable homelessness. Derek, what do you think of that? Are there Bellevue values or around homelessness, or a Bellevue kind of compassion here?
I would say my experience of working with a lot of the East Side cities, so Redmond, Kirkland, Issaquah, Bellevue, David and I were talking in the green room about exactly that, like the evolution of how our cities on the East Side are really paying attention to this issue in a compassionate way. And I think that providers and city planners and police departments and community members are all trying to come together to figure out the right solution to make it feel like we're treating people like people. And then at the same time saying that we are going to do everything we can to help you get out of homelessness, and we're going to be focused on this, and we're expecting you to be focused on that as well. And at times what David's talking about is people can be in so much like just dealing with trauma and crisis that they just need that moment to just come and feel a little bit more safe and secure, and then they're ready to talk about what's next. And I think that when you hear council members talk about like this path out of homelessness and this intentionality, I think that that's great that Bellevue's articulating that. And I also say that that's a common thread throughout our region. You know, I think that council members in Seattle or King County council members would say some of the same things, that it's important for us to be able to respond in crisis, but then also be really clear that our primary goal is to get you into housing and support you along that journey, whatever housing looks like for you.
When Seattle talks about homelessness, it's often about rising rents, addiction, mental health. Are the conversations you're having any different from that?
No.
Same.
Yeah.
Same misconceptions, would you say you're dealing with?
I think one of the things that I would say is a very common misconception is that when East Side folks look at the issue of homelessness now, a lot of times you hear like the comment that was made with the Bellevue shelter recently is that these people are from Seattle, that these people are not from our community. And that's not the data that David or I at Friends of Youth or Congregations for the Homeless have as far as our programs. The majority,
why do you think people believe that?
Because I think that the visible issue of homelessness has been centered in our urban centers for so long. And as communities start providing more services and supports, people are out asking for help because they didn't know where to ask for help before. And so
that's not new homelessness.
That's not new. I mean, it is growing. The issue is growing. That's definitely something that we would say is very clear. It's becoming more and more of a crisis. But we've always had people from the East Side that have been experiencing homelessness. And I think that that's a very common misconception that I'm wrestling with in my work.
I think the other misconception that we hear a lot is that people who are experiencing homelessness choose to be homeless. I've heard that a lot. And I think, you know, I've had the privilege of getting to get deep into hundreds, if not thousands, of people's stories. Some of them start by saying, oh, yeah, I'm choosing this. What I find is that's a defense mechanism. Once you get to know their story, nobody wants to live outside. They just don't either see a path forward, or they don't think they're going to be successful. So it's easier to tell you and me that. But people want housing. It's not a dignified way to live, to be in a tent or roaming the streets at night.
Finally, I wonder how Seattle's homelessness crisis looks from across the lake. What's one thing you would tell Seattle to do that you think might help Seattle and the East Side maybe get at solving this problem?
You know, asking that question, my first thought was I just want to humbly say thank you to Seattle. Seattle has had to support the majority of people experiencing homelessness in the region for so many years. So what I know about Bellevue, and this is less so as we've been able to grow, but people who have become homeless on the East Side have had to come to Seattle for services. That still happens. So I want to say thank you for that. After saying thank you, one of the exciting opportunities is the East Side is in probably an earlier stage to some degree of grappling with a growing homeless population and what to do is I think we have an opportunity to try to figure out how do we get everyone invested. It can't just be the nonprofits. It can't just be government. It's got to be everyone. It's got to be the community. It's got to be the business sector. And I think a lot of people get off the hook and go, well, that's not my issue. even as there are systems that they're helping to create and they're benefiting off that cause homelessness, how can we as a region get people in the room, own our part in it, and come up with some creative solutions?
I guess one thing I would say is that we don't necessarily see it as an us and them thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all part of King County, and we're all wrestling with this, even though Seattle is definitely the urban center and there's just a different reality there. I would flip the question to say, what could we do? And honestly, I think it's not just throwing money at it. Although there's unquestionably a need for more resources, it is getting back to some of the stuff I was saying at the beginning of the conversation. It's about what we as a community can do. How can employers get engaged? How can housing, how can landlords get engaged? How can we start addressing some of the stereotypes that are preventing people who are experiencing homelessness to have to keep experiencing homelessness because they can't get into housing because of background checks that are preventing them from getting in by landlords? I think the roadmap is being laid down. I think we just have to be really courageous to follow it and be ambitious about pushing it. And, you know, we just kicked off an exciting challenge called the 100-Day Challenge that's addressing youth and young adult homelessness. And First Lady Inslee was out, and we were at a beautiful room in the Pacific Tower, and she turned around and there were these windows, and she's like, look at all of these cranes, look at all of these buildings. We are growing, and yet at the same time, we have a crisis of people not having a place to live. How can we do all of this and yet not get people in housing? And when you have leadership like that, it's hard to believe that we can't do something, right? And so to answer your question, Bill, I think that let's be really courageous about the path we've set out already. I think that a lot of the recipe's there, and I think that we can do it.
David Bowling heads the group Congregations for the Homeless. Derek Wentorf is Director of Homeless Youth Services at Friends of Youth. The Bellevue City Council's working on a permanent men's homeless shelter, the first for the city, and it might go in the Eastgate neighborhood. Some Eastgate residents don't like that idea, and the city's still open to other locations, maybe Bell Red, maybe downtown Bellevue. So you just heard us there asking a question. Are there Seattle values and Bellevue values when it comes to homelessness? Bellevue City Council member Kevin Wallace said his city wants to make sure the scourge that is on Seattle's doorstep does not come to Bellevue. We're going to talk with Council member Wallace tomorrow here on KUOW, so stay tuned. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Sure, your radio is on right now, but are you really paying attention? Really? We're going to find out next month, May 24th, at Seattle's Neptune Theater. I'll be hosting KUOW's News Quiz with Ken Jennings and Luke Burbank and more KUOW friends. And you, come and prove your public radio smarts in front of a few hundred strangers. KUOW's News Quiz, Neptune Theater, May 24th. It's a Wednesday. Tickets are on sale now. See you there. If we're doing our jobs, you're going to nail this. Young immigrants across America have pinned their hopes on a case in Seattle federal court. Daniel Ramirez is the so-called dreamer who immigration agents arrested despite his protection through the DACA program for childhood arrivals. And his lawsuit aims for clarity on whether dreamers in this program are in fact shielded from deportation. For one of Ramirez's attorneys, this case is personal.
One of the things that Daniel and I really connected with was that we both had immediate family members who were deported when we were younger, and we felt that absence, and we battled through that.
That is Seattle attorney Luis Cortez, who also came here as a child, undocumented. KUOW's Liz Jones reports.
The call came into the law office on Friday from Daniel Ramirez's brother. He said immigration agents had come with a warrant for their father and ended up arresting 23-year-old Daniel, too. The brother recorded part of the arrest on his cell phone.
They woke us up. They're taking my brother for no reason at all.
I gave him a call and I said, you know what, sometimes these things happen where someone gets picked up by accident. He's probably going to be let go.
That's attorney Luis Cortez. He figured immigration officials would see that Ramirez was a DACA recipient and release him. The DACA program is for young immigrants who came here as children, giving them temporary permission to live and work in the U.S. Ramirez came here at age 7.
Later that afternoon, he called back and said, yeah, they didn't let Daniel go. And so I know from my experience, once ICE has decided to take someone down to the detention center, it's because something went wrong.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, claims Ramirez admitted to gang affiliation, which would cancel his DACA status. His attorneys refute that claim. They say Ramirez has a clean record, no gang ties, and his detention was unconstitutional.
I started really thinking about what if I was in that position as well, because as a DACA recipient, I also just had it as a given, where if I have DACA status, they can't pick me up and they can't detain me. Certainly that's, I think, an assumption that all DACA recipients have. But this case really outlines that there's nothing that says that.
That's why Cortez and others want a clear court ruling that DACA holders are safe from arrest unless it's a criminal matter. Ramirez's detention sent a chill through the immigrant community.
I'm Charlie James, you're watching ABC.
Crowds rallied, like this one in Manhattan.
In New York City, we're outside the Department of Homeland Security building.
Then ICE detained a few more Dreamers, and people wondered if DACA still offered any protection.
Recipient Daniel Ramirez Medina in Washington State.
Daniel Ramirez spent more than 6 weeks in the Tacoma Detention Center. Luis Cortez visited him almost daily, nervous at first that his own DACA status could be a liability.
There's been a lot of times where I'm thinking, I could go to the detention center to see Daniel and then I could just not leave. And I'm thinking at any given moment, please put your hands behind your back and this is it.
Initially, he says Ramirez was very reserved.
He was very afraid, and I think he really just didn't know what to do. I pulled out my work permit from Deferred Action. I showed it to him and I said, look, I have one too. So I know exactly what you're feeling. All of a sudden, Daniel started talking about the reality of him being sent to a country that he has absolutely no idea about and that terror of that possibility.
Cortez can relate. He was just a year old when he came here. And like Ramirez, he's the oldest son in his family. As time went on, the two found lots of common ground.
We eventually started talking things that are not from the case. I asked him where he was from California. I grew up in California as well. And we're both transplants to Washington. And that is an abrupt change because of the rain. Yeah, so we got pretty close. And really what it comes down to is Daniel and I, we started talking about how we are battling with our identities. You know, the first thing that people see Daniel and I are, you know, Mexican kids. We're Mexican kids. And so that's our identity right off the bat. But the way that we see ourselves is very much American.
Now, these Mexican kids are key players in this major legal challenge as client and attorney. In some ways, the roads that led them here look similar at the start, but lead to pretty different places. Ramirez dropped out of high school after his father was deported. He helped his mom pick fruit to pay the bills. Cortez started out as a teacher. He met a lot of students like Ramirez, with a parent deported and struggling. Frustrated and wanting to do more, he looked toward law school.
I'm the first one to go to college. I'm the first one to graduate from high school. So to me, law was very out of reach. When I thought about lawyer, I thought like super prestigious, like very rich and, you know, like having those resources to do that. So it was not something in my mind, but I started looking into it and I said, you know, I might be able to at least like apply.
He ended up at the University of Idaho. Money was tight. He wasn't eligible for financial aid because of his status. He borrowed books when others were done with them and studied late at night. Then in his first year of school, he read about a lawyer who was unable to work because of his undocumented status.
I was in middle of nowhere, northern Idaho, where it's just snowing and I'm by myself and I'm like trying to cram through all these books. I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to pay tuition. And then I figure out I might not be able to practice. Like, what am I doing? And so I remember calling my mom when I read the article. And I was sitting in my car and I was crying and I was like, I don't know why I'm doing this. Like, and I was so mad. I didn't even know who to be mad at. I was like, this is being ripped away from me again.
His mom gave him some tough love.
He goes, you go in there and you finish that school. If you have to work construction, you'll be one of the smartest construction workers out there. Like, you don't come back here without finishing it.
Then DACA came out right before he graduated.
For better or for worse, my status is something that has led my path, for sure. It led me through a lot of the work that I'm doing. It led me taking on Daniel's case at such an immediate time. I have a lot of faith in DACA.
Give us a few words. Tell us how you're feeling.
Daniel Ramirez left detention in late March. Attorney Luis Cortez walked him out to a throng of media.
Daniel, I'll have Daniel just say a few words.
Ramirez speaks English, but he deliberately picks Spanish for this moment.
I asked him about why, and he goes, I knew that my mom would be watching, and I wanted to send her a message, because the first thing he said is, I'm fine, thank you, everybody, I'm fine.
Ramirez has since made a brief trip to California to visit his mom and his 3-year-old son. His case is still pending in Seattle federal court. Next, a judge will decide if it has jurisdiction to hear the broader constitutional issues related to the DACA program. Government attorneys argue it should proceed like any other deportation case in immigration court. Either way, these two American-raised Mexican kids plan to see this case through together. I'm Liz Jones, KUOW News.
It's KUOW's The Record. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter all this hour, of course, at KUOW. This past fall, two high school students from Texas arrived in Seattle without any family. They came to play football for Garfield High School. The teens say they were left on their own here. Garfield designated them homeless, which made them eligible to play for the school without a neighborhood address. Now the Garfield football team's under investigation for potential violation of recruitment rules. Seattle Times education reporter Claudia Rowe broke this story. Welcome back, Claudia. Thanks for coming.
Thanks so much for having me on, Bill.
Your article focuses on one of the two Texas students, Will Sanders. How did he come to play football for Garfield High School?
So, right. I just wanted to say the other student who came with him did not ever play. My understanding is he sat on the bench quite a bit, but he didn't play. So Will Sanders told me that he posted a video on social media of himself and his friend dunking basketballs, playing basketball at the gym. And later they show up at the gym and in Texas, in Beaumont, Texas. And the guy running open gym says, hey, I heard from a dude in Seattle and he might have an opportunity for you. He might want to hook you up. And so Will Sanders ends up speaking to a couple of people from Seattle, he says. And he says one of them was the coach from Garfield High School who told him, come on up here. It'll be great for you. Fantastic opportunity. Garfield's a great school and you'll be able to play. And this is what Will Sanders is alleging, but in terms serious enough that the school district is now investigating.
Okay, we'll talk more about what's under investigation and why. Who is responsible for these two kids when they were here?
Right. So the first person who saw the video was John McKinney, and he is the father of a former Garfield football player, Cameron McKinney. John McKinney told me that he himself arrived in Seattle virtually homeless and struggling with his own problems. He's the one who brought his own son, Cam, up. Cam played one season and then went on to a college football career. And so John McKinney says he saw these other two young men from the same town in Texas and thought, hey, I could give them an opportunity too. He is the one listed as the guardian of record on Will Sanders' paperwork. But Will Sanders didn't actually live with him.
They couch surfed.
To a degree, they lived with different homes of different players. They say they also lived at the home of one coach briefly. So they bounced around quite a bit.
And they bounced around. Is that why the school counted them as homeless students?
Sure, technically. Uh-huh. That's why they certainly were not part of Garfield's neighborhood catchment area, being from Texas. And they weren't, in fact, living, as I understand it, with the person who was their official guardian, or at least who was not Will Sanders' official guardian. So yeah, they moved around from different houses, house to house. over the course of the season. And then when the season was finished, Will Sanders says they were encouraged to travel back to Texas for the Thanksgiving holiday with assurances, he says, that they would be brought back up to continue school.
Is that a rule violation right there? Suggesting you'll paying for a flight and saying we'll get you back?
It kind of depends who really paid. The question is the origination of this whole arrangement and whether the coach at Garfield in fact told these young men from Texas, I've got you, I will get you up here. They say that he said he would pay for tickets to get them up here. That technically seems that it would be a rule violation. The going back to Texas and coming up again, perhaps. But the executive director of the Washington Interscholastic Athletic Association, known as the WIAA, says that a parent helping out isn't necessarily a violation. So I will say there are a lot more questions raised by this story than answers at this point.
Where are these students now?
They are back in Seattle.
Seattle. What are they? Yeah, go on.
After they were in Texas and trying to come back here and not getting much help with that, they say they raised their own plane fare to come back. And they arrived here in March with nobody looking out for them. And eventually they were enrolled at Interagency Academy, which is an alternative school.
We mentioned this idea that they didn't have a Garfield area address. That's not exclusive to these kids, right? That's kind of an opportunity for kids sometimes. It can be a help to families, can it? To let kids go to work the system so kids can go to school?
You know, the sort of traditional model for that is a active parent who sees a shining academic school and wants to get their child into a more academic environment. And so they might fudge their address or use the address of a relative to establish residency in whatever district of whatever school.
I had a friend ask me to do that.
Right. It's commonly done. It's not supposed to be done.
I said no, by the way.
It is technically against the rules, but it is often done, and you can hardly fault a parent for wanting a better academic environment for their child. In this case, however, academics surely did not seem to be the primary consideration at play.
Yeah.
And while reporting the story, I heard many tales of kids from all over the place not living in their actual true home and being moved around so that they could attend different schools to play on different teams.
Right, right. This is bigger. This is bigger than we usually find out. We just had the scandal at Bellevue High School. The coach was fired there. School sanctioned for improper recruiting. What do these stories teach us about what's going on in high school sports, Claudia?
For me, as an education reporter, they raise a perplexing question, because what really is the gain? What is the motivation, really? You know, so maybe your team does well? Your team has a good record? Really? I think to a lot of people who are not involved with sports, that's puzzling. Perhaps there are egos at play. Perhaps there are careers at play. I don't mean students' athletic careers only. I mean adults' careers. Maybe.
Athletic directors and coaches.
Perhaps. Mm-hmm. I don't really see a financial motive on the adult end. For the young people, there may be a sense of the possibility of a college scholarship or something like that, a hand up. But that is not what happened in this case, or at least not yet.
Talking with the Seattle Times, Claudia Rowe, is there any way to prevent this kind of sports academics rule violation?
You know, there surely could be more active oversight. There is a real tradition of, I think, from what I've heard, looking away.
Yeah.
When a student is listed as homeless, this is a federal designation, McKinney-Vento status. The legislation covering homeless students is called the McKinney-Vento Act. There doesn't seem to be terribly stringent oversight of how that gets attached to a student. As I understand it from the reporting, when a student is an athlete, and they have McKinney-Vento status. It is up to somebody to bring a complaint, to bring a question to the oversight body, which is a district within the Washington Interscholastic Athletic Association. It's all very decentralized. And it is up to somebody to bring a complaint about the status of the student. And then the student must appeal the complaint. So it's not as if the outside adults necessarily are monitoring this in any active fashion.
Is there, you talked about looking away. Is there another way, realistically, to set up the rule body? Or is it just happens this way because we don't want it to be any other way? We look away.
I really can't speak at this point to anybody's motivation. What I will say is that it strikes me as curious that the oversight body in Washington State, this WIAA, is owned by, that's in the words of the executive director, owned by the member schools. So it's really, you know, the member schools are his boss. They are the boss of the WIAA, in the words of the executive director. So
you might think it's the other way around.
And you might say, huh, well, then that's the member schools essentially policing themselves or hiring the person who's supposed to police them. And that seems fraught with potential conflict.
So, Claudia, beyond policing little rule violations, and they keep popping up, and we have scandals, have for years, is there a bigger picture way to rethink this system that you take seriously? There's pay the players. There's take sports out of public schools and make it just be a club event thing and not part of public schools. What do you think about the bigger picture here?
Interesting. I spend most of my time looking at education policy. I am not a sports reporter, so I am, like everybody else, kind of feeling my way through this and trying to think through what would be a better way. I really couldn't advocate taking sports entirely out of public schools, because for so many kids, that's the magnet that will bring them to school. And the ideas behind the WIAA and the language and all the regulations is very clear about the priority of academics. That's what's in the language. And for many kids, I think that's the idea behind maintaining a certain grade point average if you're on a team, though, obviously, as we've seen in this story, that there can be overrides of those eligibility requirements, as there were in this case.
Yeah, he didn't have the grades to be eligible.
Correct.
Yeah. You said that something along the way, Claudia, that this story raises more questions than it answers. So a listener, maybe they've heard the whole thing or they've just joined us. Another high school sports scandal, maybe there's an investigation. What's the takeaway? What should we think about going into our day from your reporting?
We should all be looking at, to my mind, what's the prize here? What's the motivation? What's the goal? Why would various adults make notations in a system that override certain eligibility rules? What's the gain? Is it merely having a hot team? Maybe. I deal in questions, and that's what I want to look at. I want to understand who wins here. Who wins? It sure wasn't Will Sanders.
I think you're going to be reporting this topic for a while.
I hope people contact me with ideas.
Seattle Times education reporter Claudia Rowe, and we'll tweet out a link to her Seattle Times story right now at KUOW. Claudia, as always, thank you.
Thanks for having me on, Bill. Really interesting conversation.
It's KUOW's The Record. An amazing story from Vladivostok to the American movie screen coming up. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle filmmaker Wes Hurley grew up in Vladivostok, Russia. It was kind of like San Francisco.
San Francisco, if it was like post-apocalyptic, horrible, I probably can't swear, but not a good place.
But Wes Hurley will give this to Vladivostok. It did help inspire his new short film, Little Potato. It's about his life growing up gay in Russia, and his mom struggled to get the two of them to America. And it makes sense that Hurley makes movies now, because movies were a lifeline for him and his mom in Vladivostok. Hollywood movies in particular. They were hard to find until Hurley discovered a secret TV channel that showed nothing but American blockbusters.
So this was really exciting for as long as I could remember. We had just two channels, and there were government channels, and the most exciting thing that you could see on them was maybe soccer once in a while. Most of the time it would just be like news about productivity on farm, 1987 is up, you know, stuff like that, or an old guy playing on a piano all day. Like, that was the television. So all of a sudden we heard this rumors that, like, you know, you have to check out channel number 3 late at night. And everybody was like, what? There's no channel number 3. And so I came home. I remember I was really excited, but kind of, you know, skeptical, and turned on the dial. It was like old black and white TV with the dial to channel 3. And there was the movie Ghost, which was just like most exciting movie I've seen at that point. It was so dreamy. And from then on, everybody was obsessively watching channel number 3.
In English?
Well, what they did was, for some reason, they didn't really do subtitling in Russia. What they did was they had this one guy, or maybe it was several guys, who would dub them, and they would dub all the characters. So it's it's kind of a strange way to watch a movie, but that's, you know, that's the only way we've watched American movies, so we kind of took it for granted that that's how it is. But
so the same guy as Patrick Swayze and Demi Moore.
Same guy, and they would like cover their, basically plug their nose to supposedly to disguise their voice, because they were, you know, they were pirated movies that were not supposed to be licensed in Russia or whatever. I don't know if, you know, I don't know if that was the reason, but they all kind of had nasally.
It's voice acting.
Nasally.
It's characterization.
And they were great, actually. I mean, they were really good translators. They really captured the humor and
you loved
it. Of language. We loved it. We were so into it. And, you know, the more we watched, the more just sort of this other world emerged for us.
Why were American movies that important to you and your mom?
Well, for basic survival, it's like escapism that allows you to go on another day and kind of see a better life somewhere. You know, before we even got the secret Renegade channel number 3, where we saw American movies, we would sort of pass American movies down as an oral tradition almost, where, you know, like a friend of a friend would see like Total Recall or Terminator or Pretty Woman, and they would retell it to somebody, and then somebody would retell it to somebody else. And so the first few movies, American movies, I actually heard that way instead of seeing on screen. And then you finally get to see it, and it's so exciting. You know, it's even more exciting.
I imagine every culture has a culture of storytelling. Is there something different about an American style story than you'd ever heard?
I think part of it is we had, you know, the early Soviet cinema is very, it's all propaganda. It's all like, kind of like Hollywood films in style, but rah-rah communism. And they're really dumb, of course, and nobody wanted to see them. And so when, I believe Khrushchev is the one to sort of liberalize the movie industry a little bit. And so suddenly filmmakers could speak the truth, and they sort of went overboard almost. Every film was about how hopeless life is. I think filmmakers were just like so happy to talk about how things are, but they, in a way, you need balance. You know, you need art that shows you how things are and what needs to be fixed, but you do need stuff that, you know, that's not so gloomy. You need stuff that shows you how things could be and the world can be a better place and just helps you survive during hard times. I mean, that's another function of art, I think. And, you know, it was like, oh, happy, happy, happy place. Yes. We want to be in a happy place.
Please, a little fantasy with the realism, okay? A little of, yes, Tinkerbell's dust.
Exactly.
And movies sounded like became real important to your mom.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. It's a funny story. I remember she dated this guy for a while who was kind of a loser. The only reason she dated him is because he had a color TV and a VCR. And he would, you know, come back and break up and come back and break up. And she always took him back even though she didn't like him. And the whole time she was saving up money. And so finally she bought a VCR. And I remember he came back and she was like, I have my own VCR. Like, I'm not taking you back.
He took one look at that machine. He knew it's over. We're talking with Seattle-based filmmaker Wes Hurley about his short autobiographical film, Little Potato. What were your hopes for America for you?
Well, I knew, I knew I wouldn't be drafted in the military. I knew that I would have a chance to maybe do other things with my life. You know, in Russia, you don't really have a lot of choice. When I was growing up, you didn't have a lot of choice about what you're going to do in life. So basically, the only jobs that you can get are jobs that your family is connected to somehow. So you can't just go to school and learn whatever you want to learn and pursue that. It's just not an option. So that's a big thing, you know, just being in a place that doesn't feel like the end of the world, basically.
It's so dreary.
And then in some way also being gay, you know, played into it. I didn't really exactly know what the situation was in America or anywhere, but in Russia it really felt like I was the only gay person, you know. Knew that I wasn't, but I wasn't out. No, there's no way that I could be out.
Right.
And I imagine I would just be killed the next day, you know, considering all the things that I heard every day about gay people and how they're basically this monsters that didn't even seem real. I don't think anybody knew any gay people. It was just this mythological monstrosity, you know, the worst thing that you could possibly be.
So how did you get to Seattle?
So yeah, my mom became pen pals with an American guy. They hit it off and then they got married. And so he brought her over and then brought me over as well.
What was Seattle in reality like for you?
It was incredible. It was like better. It was as good as the movies, but better because it was real.
Oh, yeah.
Although it didn't seem real. I mean, when I talk to my mom, like neither of us feels like it's real still to some degree. You know, it still feels like we're living in a fantasy dream that we're going to wake up back in Russia.
And that was about 20 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you remember?
I just remember, well, I remember people being, you know, friendly. And where I grew up, people are always like angry, scowling. Everywhere you go, people are very just angry.
So when we say we have the Seattle freeze here, we have no idea.
No idea, no. I mean, people look at you like they're going to murder you.
in Russia.
Bus, yeah. I mean, anywhere you go. And here, you know, when I saw people like smiling at you, it took me a moment to be like, oh, they're not crazy. Like people actually smile if, you know, if your eyes connect and, you know, they say hi. And that was, it's a silly little thing. And I know it's not like, you know, some people would say, oh, it's not genuine. Like people don't really care. But actually it makes a big difference in day-to-day life when you're like surrounded by that energy instead of like murderous, angry, depressed looks everywhere, you know. And then going to the stores, for example, as cheesy as that sounds, and I'm not even I don't care now that I've been here 20 years, but like coming from Russia and going to a store and seeing everything, like all bazillion types of cheese, for example. We only had one type of cheese, like growing up. I thought cheese was just one thing.
Yeah.
I didn't think there were, you know, there was like options for different kinds of cheese. So
someone would say, hey, there's cheese.
There's cheese, yeah. And there was this cheese that could kind of, you know, it looked kind of like a cross between cheddar and Swiss. It was kind of whitish yellow. And that was the only cheese. So to be in a grocery store and see all those things, it was just like strange. Like, I don't know, like kids in Willy Wonka and Chocolate Factory. That's how we
felt.
You know, and again, gay thing, you know, starting to see that people, you know, gay people were treated like people. And even if there's discrimination, it's not like people consider you subhuman or, you know, you should be killed for being gay, you know. So that was a radical reality for me to be in this kind of environment where you're suddenly a human being, you know, even if I was the only one to know that I was gay, it still affects you.
Do you remember a moment when that dawned on you? I was seeing a couple holding hands or something?
It was definitely gradual. It took, you know, and once I realized that I still had, you know, I needed time to like accept it. Like I still, only recently do I feel comfortable like holding hands in public, and I don't think about like physical confrontation at the same time. Because that used to be for me, like I would just not be comfortable holding hands in public because I would feel like everybody's looking at me and they're gonna try to physically hurt me. You know, it's not just a matter of like judgment, it's a matter of like survival.
Well, what a story, little potato. We've just peeled the outer skin. What do you want to leave us with after all you've been through and now you've made a story about it on screen?
I just wish more Americans would not take our democracy for granted and not just vote, but actually educate themselves and just be more involved. And it seems like that's sort of is happening to some degree. There's a lot more movement now with Trump in the White House, so maybe that's a good thing. But yeah, that's my big thing, is to live in a place where like I'm basically the first generation of my family to be able to vote in an actual election. Like for me to see people in the States that have this incredible democracy that has potential to really work beautifully and not engage with it, or, you know, just be lazy and be like, oh, I don't have a candidate that I love, I'm just not going to engage. Like that is so offensive and outrageous to me. So my hope is that people get more engaged.
That was Wes Hurley, the co-director of the short film Little Potato, an autobiographical look at Hurley's life growing up gay in Russia with his mother and their struggle to make it to America. The movie has won the Grand Jury Award at South by Southwest. And now Hurley and his co-director Nathan Miller are hoping to turn it into a full-length film. And we'll be tweeting out a clip so you can watch a little bit of Little Potato. Join us at KUOW.
And I'm not proud of my address. In a torn up town, no postcode envy. But every song's like gold teeth, gray goose dripping in the bathroom, bloodstains, ball gowns stretching the hotel room. We don't care.
I'm Bill Radke. You can call me Queen Bee. Playing Lord for you, because she's one of the Bumper Shoot headliners. The lineup is just out today. There's Lord, Odessa, Weezer, get the idea, Spoon, Flume, Solange, one word headliners only, please. Crater will be there, Ruler, Froth, and Breaking the Mold, Chicano Batman, and more at Bumper Shoot, Labor Day weekend. Little more Lord.
Let me be your ruler.
Now, here's the real ticket. This is not fantasy. This is going to really happen at the Neptune Theater. I'm going to be hosting KOW's news quiz. Totally separate event now. I'm going to be with Jeopardy champion Ken Jennings, Luke Burbank, more smart, funny friends next month at the Neptune for KOW's news quiz. Because what good is listening to us all day if you can't use what you've learned to look smart in front of strangers? May 24th at the Neptune. Those tickets on sale right now. Thanks for listening. Back tomorrow.
In a torn up town, no postcode envy. But every song's like gold teeth, gray goose dripping in the bathroom, bloodstains.